We will bring the people to justice and make them accountable.
The crack cocaine CIA connection became the subject of multiple congressional investigations, and Rupert's allegations were proven correct. But no prosecutions were ever made of the CIA officials involved in the scheme. Gary Webb, the San Jose Mercury News reporter who first broke the story, was shunned by the media industry after releasing the story. He was unable to get a job, but the facts of the story were never in question. Webb committed suicide in 2004. After the crack cocaine CIA connection was exposed, Michael Rupert became well known for his exposure of government conspiracies. He questioned the official account of what happened in the September 11th attacks and became very involved in challenging the global oil industry. His most recent book and movie were both called Collapse, documenting the impending collapse of modern capitalism because of its dependence on fossil fuels. Here's a clip of the 2010 interview with Michael Rupert on KBOO, speaking with host Per Fangring.
Now, one thing you say is, you know, the collapse of industrial civilization. Now, that does not mean all civilization. It means a particular type of civilization. And so the question is, what will replace industrial civilization, hopefully?
Well, yeah, and it's not going to be obviously a one-to-one replacement. That's been made clear by everybody in the peak oil movement. And you know, we're all kind of reveling, sadly, to a certain extent, in the fact that in the mainstream media and even President Obama's speech recently, peak oil's out of the closet. It's been acknowledged. It's there. What is going to survive is going to be defined by the people who build lifeboats. The Titanic is going to sink, and there are not enough lifeboats. So not everything is going to be replaced one for one. To leave a world that looks a lot like we have now. There's going to be a lot of dislocation, but the key to survival is local food production. That's the cornerstone of everything. But then it's to become local for almost all your needs, so that within a small geographic radius, 5, 10, 15 miles, people will be able to sustain themselves to one degree or another. And that's the most important thing anybody can do right now. And what we're fighting for really is to determine what kind of civilization is going to emerge when the dust settles. Let's say it takes 20 years to reach a complete collapse, meaning that each year that comes is worse than the year that preceded it. 20 years would be very fast, but we don't know what the world's going to look like then. But we hope and we believe, and I'm thoroughly convinced from my travels all over the country, that there are going to be a lot of small local lifeboats that make it, and that's what's important.
The green energy, I think, will be lucky if it, you know, we know that it's not going to enable us to live the way we do now, and we're lucky if it enables us to live in some kind of a dignified poverty, I guess, or some kind of a sustainable economic level.
Well, what I have seen, Per, is that in some regions of the country, and let me just point out four or five specific areas, Martha's Vineyard, the whole state of Vermont, Northern California, certainly many places in the Pacific Northwest, I think some decent lifestyles are going to be very possible. It'll be different. It'll be toned down. I'm reminded of a great novel by James Howard Kunstler, also a close friend, called World Made by Hand, which is one of the greatest novels I think I've read, and it was so comforting. That showed a pretty decent lifestyle emerging, although in reduced energy circumstances. The big issue now, and what I'm convinced of, a number of projections, computer models from universities show that both coasts of Florida are going to be awash in oil in a short period of time, a few months. That the spill could coat the entire eastern seaboard up to Cape Hatteras before it turns out into the North Atlantic. Displaced persons are going to become a major issue. I mean, I can see 5-10 million displaced people coming out of the Gulf region within a few months, because of the toxicity, because of illnesses, because they can't eat. And I have predicted that a full FEMA activation will take place. And that this is a huge wild card, because when you have large amounts of displaced people moving and looking for a place to go, then things can really start to get shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And in the midst of economic collapse, I have been tracking for a year now that law enforcement agencies all over the country are chopping themselves to pieces because of budget constraints. The Minnesota State Police has a bill to cut their state police by half. Dallas, 40%. Los Angeles is down to 3.7 cars per division. Baltimore, so when you cut back on essential public services like police and fire, and you have massive unemployment, dislocated populations, and many states like California are letting felons out of prison because they can't afford to feed them, it's kind of a recipe for social unrest, and I'm pretty sure we're going to see a lot of that this summer.
Kind of like national suicide in a way.
That was investigative journalist Michael Rupert speaking with KBOO's own Per Fagering in 2010. Rupert was found dead in his home in Northern California this past Sunday of an apparent suicide.
A report released by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change this week has called on countries around the world to take aggressive action to combat human-induced climate change. The report says that nations must reduce emissions by up to 70% of 2010 levels in order to avoid the most severe impacts of climate change. These impacts could include such things as food shortages, massive species extinctions, chaotic weather patterns, including severe storms, and the drying up of large land areas, rendering them uninhabitable. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Janet Redman of the Institute for Policy Studies.
Janet, can you start by telling us about the main recommendations made in the UN climate change report that was released on Sunday?
The climate change report was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's Working Group 3 paper. And that means it's the third paper in a series of four. And this paper was about mitigation of climate change. So that means reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from human activity on the planet. So the main recommendations of this paper were that we actually need to, in fact, reduce our greenhouse gas emissions quickly and deeply, mainly by reducing our fossil fuel use and emissions from fossil fuel.
What about investments in alternative energy? Was that part of the recommendation?
Certainly. I mean, the report named a number of, potential solutions. I think that was part of the good news of this report. While it painted a very dire picture of greenhouse gas pollution, and in fact, let us know that the rate of greenhouse pollution is a lot higher, higher in the past 10 years than was previously estimated. It did name a number of what we can think of as solutions. So again, reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by moving away from fossil fuels, so that's away from oil, coal, and it talked about some new technologies that would be important. It recommended, of course, that we expand our clean renewable energy, so technologies that are already known to us: wind, solar, small geothermal. It also made some recommendations that many of us in the climate justice community think are a little bit misguided. It talked about nuclear energy as a low-carbon fuel source. Of course, there are many other environmental, human health impacts of technologies like nuclear energy. It's also talked about technologies like carbon capture and sequestration, which is, in a sense, still an experimental technology that has you capturing the CO2 emissions from, for example, coal combustion and trying to pump that back into the earth and hoping that it stays there as a quote-unquote low-carbon technology. And it spoke, of course, about using natural gas as a bridge fuel from where we are today in a very coal-heavy, globally a very coal-heavy economic mix to a lower carbon mix. So in a sense, it was a mixed bag of recommendations for what I think is most important, again, moving away from all fossil fuels, oil and gas, moving toward truly clean renewable energy like wind, solar, wave action, offshore example production here in the state.
Well, and given the current climate in Washington, it seems there would have to be a real sea change in order for policies to shift. It's funny, I saw a comic the other day about the climate change debate and someone raising the point, well, wouldn't it be a horrible thing if we created a better world and the whole thing were a hoax? Well, what do you think would have to happen in Washington to really make the changes necessary to address this global consensus that human-induced climate change is leading us toward catastrophe?
I think the most important thing we have to change in Washington, D.C. is who's pulling the purse strings of our members of Congress. So there's a reason why the members of Congress who get the most donation dollars from the oil, gas, and coal company don't want to take action on climate change, because, of course, they're being paid by that constituency not to take action on climate change. I think especially when we're looking at how Congress is talking about, for example, the Keystone Pipeline, or thinking about expansion of natural gas and this idea of a quote-unquote bridge fuel, I think the first step is political will, and the first step toward political will is getting the fossil fuel industry's hands out of the pockets of our decision makers.
One of the issues we've faced here in Oregon are cuts to subsidies for alternative energies like solar and wind. Do you see that as a possibility, the return of some of these subsidies that these companies are dependent on during their startup phases?
I mean, I hope so. I think that would be a very positive outcome or impact of this new IPCC study. I mean, I think there are two things that can happen with subsidies. It's wonderful to give subsidies to the renewable energy industry, and I think it's actually quite critical, and so we do need to bring those back. At the same time, we need to cut some subsidies to the fossil fuel industries, the oil, coal, and gas industry, to show the true cost of extraction, exploration, combustion, and disposing of waste from those industries. So I think both pieces are critical. So I think, again, what's important is making sure the EPA is protected so it can regulate some of the dirty energy sources. But you're right, bringing back in those forms of subsidies that actually take into account or internalize the benefits of renewable energy are also important. I think it's challenging right now. I don't think anyone's going to make, I mean, my sense is that there won't be, much forward movement on that, certainly before this election season, perhaps after the election season, if there are renewable energy-friendly folks in Congress, maybe we'll see some shifts there.
Is that going to give us enough time to be able to reduce emissions to the recommended levels that the IPCC report recommends?
Well, of course, the IPCC report and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is a convention that rules how 195 countries on the planet address the climate crisis, have said that we actually peak our emissions by 2015. That's next year. So, it's certainly the case that we can't wait for a good Congress or a climate-friendly Congress to act on climate change. So part of, I think, what we can do as citizens of the U.S. is start moving our decision-makers at the state level, certainly at the community level, where policymakers are much more, can be held to account more closely by voters. But I think we're going to have to, really think about how we move at the state level, given the fact that we probably won't see a comprehensive climate bill anytime soon, or even, we're going to be struggling to put pieces of regulation, pieces of financial incentives to shift from dirty to clean energy. I think one of the most exciting things that's actually happening right now is the divestment campaign that's going directly, it's kind of bypassing decision makers and moving right to the institutions who have investments to make and are saying, okay, shift your portfolio away from fossil fuels. And part of our work, I think, at ICS and at other institutions is to say, okay, and what should we shift those investments into? And how do we actually build that clean energy future here in the United States and across the planet?
Well, I think we've got some alternative energy companies here in Oregon that will be jumping at a chance to get new investors. I have been speaking with Janet Redman. She's the director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we've been speaking about the new report that just came out from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that found definitively that greenhouse gas emissions are rising, and that is linked to human use of fossil fuels. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
According to a report by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, greenhouse gas emissions dropped 3.4% in 2012, but the agency also found that it had drastically underestimated methane gas emissions from natural gas fracking operations. The research found that the decline in emissions was driven mostly by power plants switching from coal to natural gas, improvements in fuel efficiency for transportation, and a warmer winter that cut demand for heating. total greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. were on the rise until about 2007, when they started to trend downward, according to the report. A United Nations panel released a third part of a four-part global climate assessment on Sunday. That report found that the Earth had warmed about 1.5 degrees since the late 1800s due to a buildup of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. This buildup has been definitively linked to the burning of fossil fuels, along with the human industrial activity, agriculture, and deforestation. The report also projected that the temperature could rise up to 8 degrees if carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere double, with sea level rising 10 to 32 inches by century's end. In a study also published on Monday by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, suggested that the EPA has drastically underestimated methane emissions from oil and gas operations. Drilling operations at several natural gas wells in southwestern Pennsylvania released methane into the atmosphere at rates that were 100 to 1,000 times greater than federal regulators had estimated. The White House has ordered the EPA to identify ways to cut methane from oil and gas production. If the agency decides to issue new rules, they must be in place by the end of 2016.
Portland-based biotech firm DesignMedics has won a $3 million federal grant to create an anti-malaria drug that is both low-cost and non-resistant. The grant was awarded to the company and Portland State University Chemistry Department by the National Institutes of Health. David Payton, who co-founded DesignMedics, is a professor at Portland State University and works on such projects. The company specializes in developing drugs that overcome drug-resistant diseases, such as malaria strains in Africa and Asia, which can spread quickly due to genetic mutations in the disease organisms. The new drug will stop the disease from spreading as quickly and will overcome resistance to the drug. Chloroquine was used widely to treat malaria until recently, when it was rendered ineffective because of the mutation of the malaria organisms. According to the president of DesignMedics, malaria annually kills over 600,000 children under the age of 5, which is more than any other disease.
Students at Reed College are escalating the campaign to pressure the administration to divest from fossil fuels. Six students confronted the executive board on the issue at the board's last meeting. In response, the Reed College board issued a statement that they would develop a process for evaluating the students' proposal. The board also noted that the overwhelming scientific evidence for a substantial human contribution to global warming is fully accepted by the entire board. Students said that the response is encouraging, but they are wary of false promises. They say that they will not stop until the school meets their demands to freeze new investments in funds that hold the stock of the 200 largest fossil fuel companies, and to divest existing holdings in these funds within 10 years. In recent months, the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon voted overwhelmingly to divest from fossil fuels, and the Central Pacific Conference of the United Church of Christ is developing a resolution for its September 2014 assembly. The group 350.org has called on universities, churches, and organizations across the country to divest from fossil fuel companies to try and pressure the industry to move to alternative energy.
The Oregon agency that deals with workplace safety is proposing rules to minimize workers' exposure to silica dust. The dust affects construction industries and is linked to chronic respiratory illnesses and deaths. KBOO's Robert Fisher has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
OSHA recently wrapped up nearly 3 weeks of hearings on a proposed rule to limit workers' exposure to silica dust. General construction, masonry, and foundries are examples of the industries where exposure is common. Silica dust is connected to respiratory illnesses and silicosis, an incurable chronic lung disease. Celeste Munforton with George Washington University School of Public Health testified. She says safety regulations were first recommended back in 1974, and even this rule will take up to 2 years before it's put in place.
So it's really a national disgrace that we allow exposures to silica dust that are so high.
She adds that those most at risk are also most vulnerable: immigrants, people who don't speak English, and contract workers. Industry groups testified against the rule, saying that deaths from silicosis have declined. Munfortin says it's estimate that the rule will save 700 lives a year. Peter Dooley at the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health testified that workers often don't know that the dust they're inhaling can cause lifelong disabilities.
It's not like asbestos and lead hazards. This is a hazard that's not well known.
Dan Neal from the Equality State Policy Center testified in favor of the rule, saying history shows that industries won't meet limits of their own, conduct monitoring, offer medical surveillances, or provide training.
Long-term complications, impair someone's breathing, lung cancer, and kidney problems, among many other related diseases. So very important for workers to know that they've got to protect themselves and that they've got a right to protect themselves.
Exposure limits mean that businesses would have to use methods to reduce dust at work sites. That can be done with systems that use water or air through vacuum systems, or workers can be protected with respirators. For KABU Evening News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I'm Robert Fisher.
Vermont could become the first state in the union to label foods containing genetically modified ingredients. State legislators voted today 26-2 in favor of a bill that will require identification of such products by July 2016. Neighboring states have passed comparable pieces of legislation, but have delayed implementation to pursue a strategy designed to insulate them from legal action the industry may be inclined to take. Attorney General William Sorrell expects the state will have to engage in a legal battle to defend the legislation, which has happened on two occasions. The state scored a victory when it came to getting food products containing mercury labeled, but lost the fight to identify synthetic growth hormones in milk in 1996. 60 countries, including the European Union, require labeling.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Jamie Partridge as he speaks and he interviews Portland State University teacher Jose Padin for analysis of the teacher strike on KABU News in Depth right after this newscast. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud includes guests from The Living Room, the safe space for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender teens in Clackamas County. They'll be discussing their upcoming events. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock will do a Best of Hard Knock Anniversary Special. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly sunny with a beautiful high of 54 degrees and a very low of 34 degrees. There may be frost in the outlying areas.
Maybe I will meet him someday. Maybe Monday. Maybe still, I'm sure to meet him one day. Maybe
it's just about 5:31, time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When I saw the headline, I wanted to laugh out loud, but that's really hard to do when you're gritting your teeth. The headline proclaimed, "Jobs lost during slump regained." It was another smiley face sticker that the establishment media keeps trying to slap over America's jobs crisis. This story gushed that the private sector, which had punted 8.8 million jobs after Wall Street greed crashed the economy in 2007, has now reached the milestone of restoring those jobs. So see, everything is okie-dokie, and all of you hard-hit workers should quit belly-aching. Beneath the headline, though, is a much grimmer reality, for what has happened to America's workaday majority is not a slump, but a full-blown financial disaster. First, while private sector jobs are up, public service jobs are still short of the number we had before the crash. Also, population growth since 2007 means that several million new job seekers have entered the market. So, happy headline aside, job creation is nowhere near the growing demand for employment. That is truly teeth-gritting news, especially for the millions of long-term unemployed Americans who've been jobless for half a year, 2 years, or more. Second, most of the positions added by the private sector are temporary part-time jobettes with low pay, no benefits, no job security. In fact, the hiring report that prompted the joyous headline shows nearly half of the new jobs were added by temp agencies, restaurants, hotels, and retailers, all notorious low-wage employers. This is Jim Hightower saying, the only thing more shameful than these hopeless media attempts to put a rosy glow on America's unabated jobs crisis is the crisis itself. It shouldn't exist. The headline this story deserves is, Wall Street executives, corporate lobbyists, and their congressional hirelings continue to undermine America's middle class.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we're going to hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We've seen our students' tuition rising, and we've seen the wages of the workers who make the university run falling. But our members have been losing wages so drastically over the years that many of them are eligible for food stamps, they qualify for low-income housing, and we're seeing that we, along with other workers on campus, like the service workers, have been threatened, intimidated, and abused when we try and stand up for our rights and try and make this university a better place.
UAW 2865 member activist Carolyn McCusick. 13,000 University of California student worker teaching assistants are in labor contract talks again this week. Their contract expired in September of 2013. UAW Local 2865 represents teaching assistants, tutors, and readers at campuses across the UC system. During a brief strike, April 2nd, 22 people were arrested at UC Santa Cruz. The union says UC is guilty of unfair labor practices, including a refusal to negotiate. Exploitation of low-wage university labor is an overarching issue. Respect, dignity on the job, and adequate compensation for their work are what the student workers in UAW Local 2865 want.
What we've been trying to achieve in our contract campaign is a higher wage that's competitive with other universities, because we're seeing the amount of grad students coming to UC dropping as UC lets our wages fall and fall every year. But we're also fighting for the quality of education of our students, and we've been fighting to get a student voice in class sizes at the university, which have been ballooning as the UC increasingly deprioritizes education in order to make a profit.
The teaching assistants deal with hundreds of students at a time and are paid roughly $1,700 a month for 20-hour work weeks, but many put in more hours to get that work done. The fight for 15 is on in Seattle. Even as the city council is set to act soon on the $15 an hour minimum wage question, charter amendment language was filed Monday for a $15 an hour minimum wage ballot initiative in the city. Jess Spear is Seattle's Vote 15 campaign manager.
Workers in Seattle are on the cusp of making history. We stand to lift 100,000 workers in Seattle, 24% of all workers here, out of poverty by passing a real $15 an hour minimum wage. But big business has launched an assault on the movement for 15. Washington Restaurant Association, Starbucks, Alaskan Airlines, Microsoft, and others are pouring millions to undermine workers getting a full 15. So we have to defend against invasion of corporate cash. We filed a charter amendment to reserve the right for the movement to decide whether to put the question to the vote.
If the Seattle City Council fails to approve a real $15 an hour minimum wage with an index for inflation, the Vote 15 movement can collect 30,000 petition signatures to put that question to a vote of city residents. If passed by the voters, it would become part of the city's charter.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from Union-Owned Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender, doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A handful of Oregon City high school students showed their opposition to their school's participation in a national day of silence meant to call awareness to the bullying of LGBT community by wearing T-shirts reading "Gay Day is not okay." One student who spoke with reporters says he doesn't approve of gay people because he's religious and contends that the First Amendment provides him the right to express that. Though school officials indicate that they would not allow the shirts, a student dismissed the claim, saying he was asked to remove the garment, but since the policy isn't enforceable, he didn't feel compelled to comply.
Students at Franklin Regional Senior High in Pennsylvania returned to school today, 1 week after a student stabbed a number of other students. The stabbings were committed by 16-year-old Alex Hribble. He is accused of attacking 20 fellow students and a security guard with two kitchen knives before being subdued by the principal and the assistant principal. Three of the students are in critical condition. Hribble is being charged as an adult with 4 counts of attempted homicide, along with 21 counts of aggravated assault. Administrators and faculty are hoping to have things go back to normal for the students, but they are keeping a crisis counselor on hand. Teachers also attended a counseling session near the school on Monday.
A 16-year-old in Australia is facing jail time for issuing a fake press release as an April Fool's Day joke. Kudra Fala Ricketts sent out the press release from her school email address with the logo of an Australian gas company, MetGas, at the top. The press release claimed that the company had decided to pull out of the Northern Rivers region of Australia in response to community concerns. It also stated that the gas company would not continue operations in communities where they are not welcome. The 16-year-old said that she meant it as a joke to try and make people laugh, but the company responded by slapping the teen with a formal complaint that could end up with a 10-year jail sentence. A MetGas representative said that they brought the issue to the Australian Securities and Investment Commission in order to protect their profits. A company spokesperson said that if people actually believed the press release that the company was ending oil and gas drilling in favor of alternative energy, it could result in, quote, innocent investors losing money, end quote. MetGas says they'll leave it up to the Australian government to decide how to punish the child for her joke press release.
Yesterday, French authorities revealed that a laboratory associated with the famous Institut Pasteur lost 2,349 vials of the SARS virus. The Institute, famous for being first to isolate the HIV virus, insists that the specimens inside the vials pose no danger to the public. The virus was not intact in the vials, and even if they were, the viability of the virus outside the lab is negligible. The disappearance of the samples is of great concern because of the potential for disaster if a communicable disease-causing pathogen fell into the wrong hands. The Institute guards against this happening by encrypting the labels on the vials and limiting access to dangerous organisms.
Killings of people protecting the environment and rights to land increased sharply between 2002 and 2013 as competition for natural resources intensifies. A new report from Global Witness reveals this. In the most recent comprehensive global analysis of the problem on record, the campaign group found that at least 908 people are known to have died in this time, reaching an average of 2 deaths a week in the last 4 years. Disputes over industrial logging, mining, and land rights are the key drivers, with Latin America and Asia Pacific particularly hard hit. There can be fewer starker or more obvious symptoms of the global environmental crisis than a dramatic upturn in killings of ordinary people defending rights to their land or environment, said Oliver Courtney of Global Witness. Yet this rapidly worsening problem is going largely unnoticed, and those responsible almost always get away with it. We hope our findings will act as a wake-up call that the national governments and the international community clearly need.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 15th, 2014. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian woman in the West Bank and injure a worker in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Noha Katamish, 40 years of age, died on Monday night at Bethlehem City Hospital after inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli troops. Katamish was suffering from a severe case of allergy. Her respiratory system failed when soldiers fired tear gas into and around her home at Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem City, local sources reported. According to local sources, Israeli troops have been attacking the camp since Saturday and firing tear gas into residents' homes and streets. On Tuesday, a Palestinian worker was shot and injured near the Erez crossing at the northern borders of the Gaza Strip. Local sources announced that the man was working in lands close to the borders when troops manning military watchtowers opened fire at him. He was moved to a hospital after sustaining moderate wounds. Israeli troops regularly open gunfire at residents and workers while working at farmlands close to the Israeli borders with Gaza to force them to leave those lands. In other news, Israeli troops kidnapped on Tuesday a Palestinian man close to the Israeli illegal settlement of Ariel in the northern part of the West Bank. Soldiers claimed that while searching the man, they found a knife with him and that he confessed that he wanted to stab an Israeli soldier at a nearby military checkpoint. No Palestinian source confirmed the Israeli army story. Elsewhere in the West Bank, Israeli soldiers placed a full siege on the town of Idna, west of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, and initiated a large-scale search campaign that targeted dozens of homes and stores in the town. Local sources reported that the army attack started on Monday evening after an Israeli settler was shot and killed and three others were injured near the town. No Palestinian group claimed responsibility for the attack on Monday night. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, April 15th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Steve Hassett, Kristen Yount, Robert Fisher, and Genevieve McDaniel. The producer and engineer is the amazing Sequoia Wright. Special thanks to reporter Jamie Partridge. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. I'm Kristen Yount.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Political Perspectives with news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. We invite listeners to call in at 503-231-8187. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Food Show features an interview with Laura Pacheco, owner of Seed and Thistle Apothecary. They'll also talk with Jeannie Marshall, author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids. They'll also interview Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, about the Feast and Famine exhibition currently on display. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support of community radio. If you're not a current member, become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. I'm here talking to Jose Padin, who's a sociology professor at Portland State University and a member organizer with the Association of University Professors, which has just signed a tentative agreement with the Portland State University administration after a year of bargaining, organizing, and mobilizing your members, students, and community allies. And the settlement came just days after the union filed a strike notice. So how do you feel about the agreement, Jose Padin?
I feel very good about it.
So what were the big wins in this agreement?
The big wins were in the area of faculty stability. We managed to get multi-year contracts for 80% of what are known as fixed-term faculty here, folks who are normally on a year-to-year contract. The administration came in wanting to give us 0%. The compromise along somewhere along the line during the year was 45%. We got 80%. We want to fight for 100% multi-year contracts, but 80 ain't a bad place to start. We managed to retain very important language in our contract, language protecting our role in shared governance, number one, which they wanted to rip.
And tell us what you mean by shared governance.
The faculty and academic professionals, organized as the Academic Senate at Portland State University, develop the standards for promotion and tenure. And we have in our contract language that allows us through our union to veto any efforts that the administration might pursue of changing those unilaterally. So we managed to preserve that. To us, it was a big red flag that they even wanted to touch that language because it's been there from the beginning.
And besides shared governance, what else?
Well, very important in contracts, the protection of the past practices. They wanted to rip an article that protects all past practices, and that gives us a lot of leverage as a union to make sure that things that get decided on a day-to-day basis that are part of shared governance, because you can't script them in any contract, if they're established, that they don't get changed unilaterally. That just gives too much power in the workplace to management.
And I've seen a reference to academic freedom.
Well, that refers to the shared governance and promotion and tenure guidelines. If they take us out of the equation, we're going through a transition here in Oregon higher education system, where each one of our campuses has their own new governing board. And in this transition, the rules can be completely rewritten. And our governing board doesn't necessarily know the academic traditions that have protected for over 100 years academic freedom, and among them is shared governance and tenure. And we want to make sure that folks who don't understand the importance of those aren't tempted to just rewrite the rules.
So big gains with job stability and retention of shared governance and academic freedom. And what were the, or is there more that you wanted?
I'd say one more really important. We have a whole category of people in a bargaining unit, academic professionals. And there was an attempt to rewrite language that had an impact on them that would have made it really, really easy to restructure units and dismiss people. And we managed to make sure that that wasn't changed.
And were there major concessions in the contract that you signed?
There were things we didn't get that we still need to work on, and it is on the salary front. We did make some gains there, but our cost of living adjustment doesn't keep up with inflation, so we continue, you know, slipping there.
So you're saying that some of the faculty or academic professionals actually are taking a pay cut with this agreement?
Some are. Now, on the salary front, it's a complicated set of gains because in addition to just the cost of living adjustment, we have compression adjustments and equity adjustments. So any individual member of our bargaining unit may qualify for up to 3 different salary increase types. When you put them together, they probably make you good with inflation. So that's not great. And the thing is, a couple of them have to do with compression. And so if your compression adjustment and your COLA and everything else put together just about matches inflation, that's not a great gain there.
What does compression mean?
Well, compression, the longer you stay at Portland State University, the further behind you fall behind comparator institutions. Younger people are coming in and their compensation coming in approximates what's being paid in the market a little bit. And that means that in some cases they exceed in compensation people who've been here for a long time. So it's an attempt to make up that lost ground for folks who've provided years of service.
Why is it that you think that the administration backed off of so many of their demands?
Well, the short answer is because we called a strike. And not only we called it, but we had a credible strike threat. It was very clear that we were organized and we were ready to come out, and we had huge community and student support. So the strike was credible, and we were convinced, and we convinced them that we were convinced that we were going to come out, and it would have shut down the university. 70% of the classes would not have been taught.
So what do you think, what were the changes that took place within the faculty that made this possible?
Well, our association became a union. We went from being a gentleman's club to being an actual organization that mobilizes people, educates them, and teaches them to stand up for what we say we believe. So all of a sudden, we convinced after a year the administration that we really mean what we say and we'll back it up with actions. We couldn't do it before.
And how did you go about making that happen within the faculty?
Organize, organize, organize. Build pride, set goals every month for an action and exceed them consistently. And every step you take already gets you halfway to the next step. Somehow that works.
How long was this contract campaign? When did you get going with it?
Really? I'd say September, the month after our contract first expired. So never give up on the sick patient. There's always hope.
Well, and it was a six-month battle.
It was. It was.
So how did student organizing impact the outcome?
I think it was huge. First of all, you know, the students were wind, you know, behind our backs, just pushing us all along, and they're a significant source of inspiration. So we had on February 27th a very successful, what we called info picket rally. Just kind of a dress rehearsal for what the strike might look like. And we had about 350 of our members out there on a very rainy day, and a lot of people are teaching, and that was great. But then about 800 students come out, and they walk out of classes. And that was huge. I mean, it convinced a lot of faculty that may have been hesitant to organize towards a strike that it was the right thing to do, because their students were saying, "Hey, you've got to do that. And B, we give you permission to strike. It's the right thing." And then a lot of our colleagues start realizing that standing up for the right thing is an educational opportunity not to be missed. It's a great example for our students. They are workers too, and many of them are in the transition to the workplace. So we've got to model what's right for them. So all of these things came together, and I think they inspired, they galvanized us, no question.
So I've seen around the campus, I've seen posters just today that from the Portland State Student Union saying, "We won. Huge increases in job security, protecting traditions of shared governance and academic freedom for our faculty and academic professionals. Next steps, debt-free higher education, 50% of budget to the classroom, student-faculty-led university." What do you think about all that?
Well, I think that's great. And what the students are articulating is that they bought wholesale into what we bought also. And it's the notion that our working and teaching conditions are their learning conditions. And they're inseparable. So our gains are their gains and vice versa. And what they're pointing to there, which is a debt-free higher education, is our goal in what we're calling the long campaign now, which is reclaiming taking back public higher education and making it accessible universally so that it is debt-free, so that it's really a citizenship right, and it's not simply something available to people who can afford it.
You talk about the students' learning conditions being the same as the faculty's working conditions. That's a slogan that came out of the Chicago Teachers Union struggle, and the Portland Association of Teachers in their contract battle used that same slogan. What did you all learn from the Chicago and the Portland teachers?
I think what we all learned from Chicago is you don't give up. The odds against the Chicago teachers seemed huge. First of all, they were fighting a mayor who is just a thug and is well-connected and was well-funded. And they have a huge metropolitan area. They have many, many, many schools. It's a huge challenge to organize in that city. And they managed to win that battle. So if they could, we all can. And that was a turning point for all of us, I think.
So how does this struggle for the university that Portland deserves fit within this larger education justice battle that involves the Chicago teachers and the Portland teachers? How does it fit within this public sector struggle against austerity and union busting and privatization?
The university that Portland deserves, by Portland we mean working people, citizens, not the corporate class in our community. They need to take the back seat. The wealthy in our country aren't paying their fair share of what it takes to keep this society going. So we mean that our Portland University, this is just our local struggle for what's the larger struggle, which is in this case the right to universal and freely accessible higher education. And likewise with all sorts of public services, we have the healthcare front, we have any number of fronts, so it's connected. We've seen 3 decades of attacks on our safety net and our public services, and they're in tatters, and I think the time has come when the pendulum is going to swing back.
So what do you think it's going to take to win?
Organize, 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 and it's going to take people discovering the joys of really collective action, because there's a huge amount of joy, and there's no amount of thrill that the marketplace can give you that parallels this. There's nothing that you can gain as a consumer purchasing anything that brings back the satisfaction of just joining a bunch of people and doing the right thing. Life is short, and when you go back on it, you're not going to think of the last iPod you bought. You're going to think of the last fight you won.
And what are the immediate battles ahead, and how do you hope to wage them?
Well, we need to do 2 things. What's killing our universities is a scissors effect. Locally, we have just crooked priorities in the budget. They're not going into education, and at the state level, we don't get sufficient funding. So we need to wage those 2 battles simultaneously. They're both about money, but they're both about responsibility. Stewardship of public resources and making sure that free riders in our state and in our country aren't free riders anymore.
Anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the struggle here?
Well, the Portland community in general was huge support as well. We had CABU and Portland Jobs with Justice and the Portland Alliance and unions statewide. They just poured in with their support, and they wrote letters to our administration, and you had our backs all along. So that was extremely important to our struggle, and we are ready to be there for one another, for your struggle and for any other of our educator and non-educator unions. But it was very important. Solidarity forever.
All right. Jose Padin, American Association of University Professors here at Portland State University. Thank you, Jose.
Thank you.
Ear to the Streets of Portland is a dynamic broadcast with a mix of music and conversations focusing on organizers and Black African Portlanders around the city. Tune in into the next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland with music and conversations featuring Michael Hicks of the Black Rose Books and the creator of the upcoming Portland Natural Hair Expo in May. Next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland is Thursday, April 17th, starting at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KABU 90.7 FM Portland, or online at www.kabu.fm.
People ask me everywhere, is that really all your
When our children are old, they'll know land can't be sold.
KABU is a co-sponsor of Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence, this Sunday, April 20,
all day at Portland State University. Part of PSU's Earth Week activities, the theme of the gathering is Resist, Restore, Re-inhabit. The event is free and will feature a full slate of panels, including a history of the bioregional movement, emergency preparedness and community resilience, bioregional governance, biocentric resistance, and much more. For more about the event and a full schedule, go to cascadiaconfluence.org or go to their Facebook page. Again, that's Cascadia Rising this Sunday, April 20, beginning at 9:30 a.m. on the second floor of Portland State's Smith Memorial Union on Southwest Broadway in downtown Portland.
No tyranny, we'll make a true democracy. Soon one day Cascadia shall be free.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO Portland. My name is Carla, and tonight we're going to be welcoming Jefferson from The Living Room, which is the safe space for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning youth and their allies located down in Clackamas County. We're going to be hearing about their upcoming Alternative Pride, as well as all the different services that are offered at The Living Room. So stay tuned to hear from Jefferson and a lot more about this special programming serving young people. Now, before we get to our interview, I want to let you know that later in the show, we're going to be offering a pair of tickets to the Red Dress Party. Now, for those that aren't familiar with this big event here in Portland, the website is reddresspdx.com. And the one thing that is required to attend this party, everyone must be wearing a red dress. So the Red Dress Party is happening on April 26th. And later in the show, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to the party. So stay tuned for that. In the second half of the show, we're going to be airing This Way Out, which is the International Gay and Lesbian News Magazine. This Way Out is also created entirely by volunteers. And if you're not familiar with this long-run news magazine serving our community, you can check out their website at thiswayout.org. Now, we're going to take before we take a short musical break, I want to let you know how to connect with us online. We love to hear from our listeners. You can email us at outloudradio@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for KBOO Out Loud. Now, again, connecting with us on Facebook will let you know about special things that are going on here at Out Loud, as well as things that are happening within the KABU community. Now, I'd also like to let you know about future volunteer opportunities. We are very interested in having the community contribute to Out Loud. This show is created entirely by volunteers, and you can find out how to volunteer here at KABU on the website, kboo.fm/volunteer. You do not need to have previous radio making experience. KABU offers lots and lots of free training, and if you've already been involved with KABU, but you'd like to get involved with Out Loud specifically, email us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address, again, is outloudradio@gmail.com. Now, we're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back in just a few moments to speak with Jefferson and to hear more about the Living Room located over in Clackamas County. But we're going to take a short musical break, and I wanted to offer this song in acknowledgement of Passover, a very special holiday for our Jewish friends and family. This musician uses the name Athens Boys Choir, and the song is titled Easy Heeb.
I'm the easy heaver, famous coast to coast at every JCC. Now all the girls in town want to touch this. All the bubbies in town want to this. So come on back to my place and break bread. Drink some Manischewitz, go back to my bed. You're a goyim, I'm a wayward Jew, but we go mashugan over my sabbat.
There must be something in that dumpling, cause all Shabbos we be humping.
Now my bubby wanted a doctor to marry me, and you got two PhDs, one in fine and one in sexy. You cardiac arrest me each time you lay next to me.
Singing, singing,
you know me, I'm the easy heat. Famous coast to coast at every day, say, say. Now all the girls in town want to touch this. All the bubble beats in town want some with this,
with this, with this, with this.
Now you're a coy boy and I'm a goy boy. Had me talking about my before we first kissed. Had me making wish lists of Hanukkah gifts, cause we still get them behaving less than Christian.
Oy vey, you gay, let's go back to my place. Give those jeans of yours a hasty tour of my bedroom floor.
But try to talk politics, you go Zsa Zsa Gabor.
You say we're too cute to be just...
Let's go on an Olivia Cruz vacation. Let's talk Palestinian liberation. From inspiration to perspiration, we won't stop the beat till the world be changing. No, we